At Lowe's, loyalty is royalty. With Christmas right around the corner, treat yourself for less during the holiday season. Rewards members get early online-only access to Black Friday doorbuster deals on Thanksgiving Day, like the Hisense side-by-side fridge, just $799. Not a member? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid 11/27 only on Lowe's.com. Member only doorbusters and Midnight Eastern. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Over the last several weeks, we've been focused on Chris's trial, the evidence and the witnesses that the jury heard, the evidence that convicted him. Today, we're going to shift our focus. We're going to examine the element of this case that I teach my investigative journalism students to always be mindful of. I teach these young adults to always ask one basic question: what are they not saying? In this case, the thing that the state is not saying is anything related to physical or forensic evidence. The case against Chris Bynum was built on smoke and mirrors. You heard in the state's closing things like, "You know that Chris Bynum had a 38 caliber pistol because he told you in his statement that he did. What are they not saying? We need you to believe that everything in the confession is true, at least the parts that are convenient to our case, because we couldn't find one single shred of evidence to support the fact that Chris had access to a gun, 38 caliber or otherwise." The entire case was built around this premise. In an untaped, non-transcribed interview, Chris Bynum said that he was involved in these murders, and therefore, he must have been. But what are they not saying? The truth. That they can't actually prove it. So all of this leads us to an obvious question. How do you prove someone committed a crime? The answer is simple. Evidence. Real evidence. And ideally, forensic evidence. The Ballfield crime scene in particular was exceptionally violent. It wasn't like the house crime scene where three people were shot in quick succession and the killers fled. At the Ballfield, a car was moved. Liz was beaten over the head with some type of heavy cylindrical object. The offender attempted to remove her shirt by force. She was dragged into the woods. Sheila was fully nude, indicating some type of physical contact with her murderer or murderers. There should be evidence, real physical evidence, left behind on that crime scene. We shouldn't be forced to just accept that Chris was responsible because his statement says that he was responsible for the other three murders. Show me the evidence. Well, that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to show you the evidence that the jury wasn't permitted to hear about at trial, starting with fingerprints. Throughout this episode, I'm going to ask you, all of you, ordinary people, most without any law enforcement experience, to put yourselves in the positions of the detectives on this case. I want you to think about how you would investigate it. How would you seek justice for Liz, Sheila, Angela, Suzanne, and Amp? I'll tell you up front that there were no useful fingerprints found at the house crime scene, which isn't surprising. One latent was discovered on a beer bottle, and it ended up matching Amp. Other than that, there's nothing of note at that scene as far as forensic evidence. So let's focus on and think through the ball field. What do we know? We know from the blood on the ground and the drag marks in the snow that the attack began by the dugout, not too far from the road. We also know that the car Liz was driving was found pulled much further back, about the middle of the outfield, and pulled up into the woods so it was hard to see from the road. Putting both of those facts together, and what does that tell us? It tells us that the killers moved the car after the fact. It makes almost zero sense that Liz would drive her car all the way back there, park it, and then walk all the way back to the dugout to meet whoever she encountered there that night. Now, I'll add the caveat that it is possible that the meeting took place at the car's location and Liz ran away, and that's why we find the large blood stain up at the dugout. But I doubt it. That would mean that the offender carried whatever they hit Liz over the head with while they were chasing her. I would think the most likely scenario is that the car was moved after the fact in order to conceal the crime scene. So, with that being said, put your detective hat on. Where do you think would be the best place to dust for prints? You're exactly right. The car. This scene doesn't read to me as premeditated, not like the house. Something went wrong here. The killers didn't plan this, which means it's very likely they didn't take precautions, like wearing gloves. So yes, of course, you dust the car for fingerprints. And to his credit, Bertozzi did precisely that. And it worked. He found two clean, latent prints in the car. The report doesn't say where on the car, just that they were found on the car. So there you go. You've got a lead now. And since you have a quasi-confession on the record from Chris, all you should need to do is find out who those prints belong to. Again, you're the detective. Who do you compare the prints to first? You're right again. Obviously, first you need to rule out Liz and Sheila. And then, of course, you'd want to compare them to Chris. And considering the fact that in Chris's confession, he said that Amp was in the car as well, you should probably compare the latents to him as well. And Bertozzi did almost all of that. But not until September, 7 months after Chris was arrested. And to be fair, I don't know when he submitted the prints to the Lake County Sheriff's Department lab, but the results didn't come in until September 22nd. But I highly doubt in a quintuple homicide that the lab would take 7 months to process the prints. In any case, Bertozzi submitted two prints and requested that they be compared to Chris Bynum, Liz, and Sheila. And here are the results from the lab report. Quote, the latent prints were compared to the inked fingerprints of Cleveland Christopher Bynum, Elizabeth Daly Ayers, and Sheila Barty, with negative results. End quote. All right, gumshoes, so now what? The prints don't belong to Liz, Sheila, or Chris. So we have two unknown fingerprints on a car that was likely moved by the offenders in a murder case. Your main suspect has been ruled out, as have both victims. What do you do next? Well, I think you have to compare them to Amp, just because he was part of Chris's statement. And after that, if I were the detective on the case, I would compare them to Shaky and Terrell, right? Since they were both in Chris's original story. And also remember, the car didn't belong to Liz, it was her friend Tom's car. So I'd want to rule him out as well. And if none of that gave me a match, then I would enter the prints into APHIS to see if we can figure out who they belong to. I would be beyond shocked if these offenders didn't already have a record. This type of violence isn't something you generally see from first-time offenders without violent pasts. They're most likely in the system. And that's what I would do. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that these are the same steps all of you would take as well if you were in charge of the investigation. I mean, the steps are pretty damn obvious if your goal is to actually solve the case. But here's what the Gary PD and the Lake County Prosecutor's Office did. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Once they determined that the prints didn't belong to the victims or to Chris, they never did any more comparisons. And to my knowledge, those prints have still to this day never been compared to anyone else and have never been run through APHIS. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all from Menards.
Now let's move on to DNA, something we heard nothing about at trial. In fact, even when we examined the autopsy report, it wasn't clear that sexual assault kits were taken from Sheila and Liz. To refresh your memory, Liz's report said that a kit was taken, but there was no indication that one was performed on Sheila, who was found nude at the crime scene. But as it turns out, kits were taken from both of them. And just to make sure everyone knows what I'm talking about, a sexual assault kit means that DNA swabs are taken from a victim's mouth, vaginal cavity, and rectal cavity. The purpose is obviously to have DNA to compare to any known suspects or to run through CODIS. In this case, the purpose seemed to be, well, just checking off boxes. The swabs were taken and never compared to anyone before trial. And this is a perfect example of the state avoiding looking for bad evidence that might hurt their case. Chris's statement didn't indicate any type of sexual assault. I mean, hell, it didn't even mention the fact that Sheila was nude. And let's be real, I don't think the detectives or the prosecutors actually thought Chris was guilty at all. Which would mean that finding anyone's DNA besides Chris's and either of the two victims would be a big problem at trial. They would have to disclose that information to the defense, who would have used it to rip apart the state's flimsy case. So the detectives had two options. Either process the DNA evidence and try to figure out if there's any there who it belongs to and actually investigate these murders, or put the kits on a shelf, never test them, and proceed forward with prosecuting innocent Chris Bynum, which is exactly what they did. So it wasn't until 2017, 16 years after the trial, that Chris's appellate attorneys were able to get approval from the court to test those sexual assault kits. They were sent to Bodie Labs, who coincidentally is the same lab that's currently testing the evidence in the West Memphis 3 case. Bodie tested vaginal, rectal, and oral swabs from both women. From that testing, they were able to develop two comparable major DNA profiles, as well as two minor profiles that they weren't able to fully develop. Chris Bynum was ruled out as a contributor from all swabs taken from both kits. The two major profiles came from particularly relevant swabs. Now we know, or at least we believe, that Liz likely had sex prior to going to Michelle's house that night. Remember, we heard from her daughter Tasha that Liz directly told her that she was going out to do sex work that night to earn money to buy drugs. Because of that, her vaginal swab could have produced results that weren't relevant to the murder investigation. But that's not where the comparable DNA came from. Bodie was able to develop a full DNA profile with a male who is not Chris Bynum from Liz's oral swab. Now that's particularly relevant because a semen deposit in the mouth cavity isn't detectable in large quantities for very long. I've read several studies on the matter this week, and there's no hard cutoff. Some studies show that it's possible to still have semen at detectable levels for up to 6 hours after oral sex. But that time frame is kind of misleading. Detectable doesn't mean meaningful volume of DNA. The study also notes that several factors can influence the time frame, like smoking, eating, drinking, brushing teeth, mouthwash, even spitting. In this case, the lab found a significant volume of semen, enough to develop a full major male profile. Practically speaking, it's extremely unlikely that would still be present from hours earlier, before Liz went to Michelle's house. More than likely, the deposit came from someone she had direct contact with shortly before being murdered. The other major profile is perhaps even more important. We know what Sheila was doing all day that day. She was hanging out at Michelle's house. No sex, no sex work, just hanging out with her friend. Of course, the detectives didn't bother to dig into her victimology enough to know for sure that she hadn't recently had sex, like maybe the day before or earlier that morning, but there's certainly no evidence to indicate that she had. Then there's the fact that Sheila was found fully nude, an obvious indicator that she was sexually assaulted moments before she was killed. And that second major DNA profile came from Sheila's vaginal swab. I don't think there should really be any question that whoever deposited that DNA into Sheila is directly connected to her murder. I can't even begin to attempt the mental gymnastics it would require to explain that DNA away. She was with her friend, not having sex, all day. She was found nude, and there was enough volume of male DNA in her vaginal cavity to develop a full major profile. So full, in fact, that the profile was sufficient enough to run through CODIS. And that's exactly what was done in 2018. And lo and behold, there was a match. And not some innocuous, maybe it doesn't mean anything kind of match. A match that, in my opinion, should have resulted in Chris Bynum's conviction being overturned immediately and this case actually being solved. The DNA didn't come back to a person. Instead, it came back to a crime scene. On February 19th, 2010, 10 years almost to the day after Chris Bynum was locked up, a home invasion and murder occurred at 2575 Decatur Street in Lake Station, Indiana, just down the road from Gary. I'm still working on getting more information about this case, but from what I understand at this point, someone forced their way into the home of a man named John Brooks and shot and killed him. The paperwork I found so far seems to indicate that it was a dispute over drugs. And during the course of their investigation, the Lake County Sheriff's Department took a DNA swab off of the doorknob at the house. And they were able to develop a full profile from that swab. Mr. Brooks, the victim, was ruled out as a contributor. So the detective in charge input the profile into the CODIS database. This was in 2010, and the search didn't return any hits, because the Gary PD didn't bother putting the DNA from their 2000 case into the system. Remember, they just left theirs sitting on a shelf. But the way CODIS works is once a profile is put into the system, it becomes part of the database. So the DNA from the 2010 case was put in, and in 2018, when the vaginal swab from Sheila was finally entered, the system alerted to the match. What we know with 100% certainty is this. In February of 2000, someone had sex with Sheila Barty, likely just before or during the act of a double homicide. Then, almost exactly 10 years later, that very same person left his DNA on the doorknob of the scene of a brutal home invasion murder. And there's more. We actually know who committed that murder. On November 11, 2011, a man named Leon Frevel pled guilty to the home invasion and murder of John Brooks. So, at a glance, it would seem like we have our guy, right? Well, it's not that simple. The CODIS hit came back to the doorknob, not to Leon Frevel. And while it seems like the DNA would be the likely reason Frevel was caught, according to my research, that's not the case. Here's the problem. By the year 2011, when Frevel was convicted, Indiana required anyone convicted of a felony to have their DNA input into both the state and federal DNA databases, which means that when the DNA from Sheila's rape kit was entered in 2018, Leon's DNA was in the system, and it did not come back as a match to the DNA from our crime scene. What does that mean? It means that the case against Leon Frevel in the home invasion murder case was built on something other than the DNA from the doorknob. And remember, he wasn't tried. He pled guilty. Which really only tells us that he didn't like his chances at trial. Not necessarily that he was the actual killer in the case. And his plea agreement sentenced him to less than 40 years when he would have been facing life. So that tells me the prosecution wasn't particularly thrilled about their case either. But because of these unknowns, what I'm working on now is filing FOIA requests to try to get more details on how Frevel became a suspect and why he pled guilty. If his conviction is legit, then at the very least, this is a major lead. It could be a case similar to Chris's, in the fact that there were at least two offenders and only one was convicted. That would be the most simple explanation. Or it could be that the DNA on the doorknob is unrelated to the home invasion, but still connected to the drug dispute. Or it could be that Leon Frevel, just like Chris, is also innocent. We just don't know yet. We need more information, and that's what I'm working on. But what we do know is that one way or another, these two cases are absolutely connected. Now let's move on to the other major DNA profile from our case, the one from Liz's oral swab. Just like with the vaginal swab from Sheila's kit, this one was also run through CODIS in 2018. And just like with Sheila's kit, it returned a hit. Only this time it wasn't a match to a crime scene or a piece of evidence. It was a match to a person.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The full major profile obtained from Liz's oral swab tells us, at the very least, that the contributor was with her on the night that she was murdered. While I think it's most likely that the DNA was deposited at the time or just before her murder, there's no real logical argument that it didn't happen at least in the hours before her death. Which means that whoever's DNA it is, at that very least, had contact with Liz shortly before she was killed. He could be a suspect or he could be a witness. And we know exactly who he is. When the DNA was entered into CODIS, it returned a hit. A match to a man named Joseph D. Tidwell, who at the time and still today is an inmate in the state of Mississippi. Following the hit from CODIS in 2019, a request was made to the state of Mississippi to provide a current sample of Tidwell's DNA for what's called a confirmation test. The warrant was honored, and the test on the sample received confirmed what CODIS had already indicated. It was indeed Joseph D. Tidwell who had oral sex with Liz Ayers on the night that she was killed. Now, I want you to put your investigator hat back on again. After all these years, you now have two names connected to this case. Leon Freville pled guilty to a murder where the same person who had sex with Sheila Barty on the night she was killed had touched a doorknob. And Joseph Tidwell, another convicted felon, absolutely had oral sex with Liz Ayers on the night she was killed. So what do you do next? See? I knew you were all shrewd investigators. Exactly right. You go interview both of these men and try to ascertain how they are connected to your case. But that's not what the Lake County Prosecutor's Office did. Instead, they argued in Chris's appeal on these issues that the DNA was irrelevant to the murders. They cited the fact that Liz was a sex worker, and I've been told they even made the baseless claim that Sheila was too. And the appeals court bought it, and Chris's appeal was denied. To recap, we have two unknown fingerprints found on Liz's car that have never been compared to anyone except Chris and the victims. There was also a hair found and collected from that car that's never been tested as well. I didn't mention that earlier. We also have a DNA profile from Sheila's vaginal swab that's linked to a 2010 homicide where somebody is currently sitting in prison after pleading guilty. And we have the DNA from Liz's oral swab that is a direct match to convicted felon Joseph D. Tidwell. Remember the premise of this episode. What would you do if you actually wanted to solve this case? And furthermore, that question I'm always asking you to consider. What are they not telling us? In this case, there's a glaring example of what they're not telling us. Why was Joseph Tidwell never investigated once it was proven without a doubt that he has a direct connection to this case? Why has no one from law enforcement that we're aware of made the trip to Mississippi to interview him? Well, some investigators who worked on this case during the appeal before I got involved had that same question. They did some digging and connected a few dots, and suddenly the answer becomes glaringly obvious. At the time of the murders, Joseph Tidwell's father was an active Gary City police officer. Joseph D. Tidwell was convicted on multiple counts of obtaining controlled substance by fraud in 2016, 8 counts to be exact, and he received the maximum penalty of 5 years in prison for each offense, totaling a 40-year sentence. Currently, his projected release date is September 9th, 2052. He's 50 years old right now, so he's due to be released when he's 77 years old. I did a little bit of research into what those charges could mean, and there are a lot of possibilities. Using fraudulent prescriptions to get drugs is an example. Now, I don't know how the previous investigators found themselves on the trail of Tidwell being related to a Gary cop originally, but I do know how they proved it. In the exhibits from Chris's appeal, there's a copy of a Joseph D. Tidwell's notice of retirement from the Gary Police Department. Same name as our guy. So there's our first clue. He retired from the force on August 1st, 2006. So he was still an active officer in 2000 when the murders occurred. Now, it could still be argued at this point that the names of the two men, both living in Gary, Indiana, in February of 2000, is just a coincidence. So, the investigators took it a step further. They managed to obtain Officer Tidwell's insurance enrollment form from June 2, 1986. And the form lists his dependents. His wife, Lorraine, and his four children, Enrico, Janita, Sabrina, and Joseph D. Tidwell, Jr. And just in case you don't think that's evidence enough, still could be a coincidence, Joseph D. Tidwell, Jr.'s birthday is on the form, September 20th, 1975. And the birthday listed for the Joseph D. Tidwell that the DNA matches, according to the Mississippi Department of Corrections, is, you guessed it, September 20th, 1975. Without question, the Joseph Tidwell, who had oral sex with Liz Ayers on the night that she was killed, who was never investigated even after his DNA was confirmed to match the crime scene, was a Gary police officer's son. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.